from WBUR Boston, I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Oscar Wilde once said, "A little sincerity is a dangerous thing, and a great deal of it is absolutely fatal." Sincerity is the alignment of our inner and outer selves. It goes back only a few hundred years, but it has already inspired holy wars and high art. It is both cherished by hipsters and one of the central themes in American politics. This hour on Point, a look at sincerity and why we might be better off with a little less of it. You can join the conversation. Do you value sincerity in yourself, in your politicians? Do we care about it too much? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Hartford, Connecticut, is R.J. McGill. He's an intellectual historian and author of the new book, Sincerity, How a Moral Ideal Born 500 Years Ago Inspired Religious Wars, Modern Art, Hipster Chic, and the Curious Notion That We All Have Something to Say, No Matter How Dull. R.J. McGill, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Wade.
Well, that is quite the title to your book.
It's long.
when I think about this, a young woman who is suspicious that the young man she's with is more interested in what he can get than the woman he's getting it from, and our politicians, if we believe that he cares more about our vote than about what we care about, we call him a flip-flopper. How can sincerity be something that we should be suspicious about?
Well, hopefully the book answers a little bit of that. First of all, thanks for having me on the show. It's a real privilege.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. When we hear the word sincerity, it sounds welcome. It's something that what we want to have, that we look for in our intimate relationships between with our friends and with our family and so forth. And it's undoubtedly a very important virtue to cultivate between close people. And we like sincerity because, as you just said, it convinces us that the person who we think is sincere is not using us for some ulterior motive, that they're really present, that they're interested in connecting with us in some way. And in this way, sincerity, as you mentioned, is a matching of the inner person with his or her outer expression. What this book does is investigates how this moral value came to be and why, but it also casts doubt on how much sincerity we should demand and from whom. As with many things, it's the dose that makes the poison. Or as M. Somerset Maugham once said, "I don't think you want too much sincerity in society. It'd be like an iron girder in a house of cards." So while it's important for, sincerity is important between our close relations, in public life, it seems like a misplaced demand. And I'm curious, I was very curious of why that value became so important to place upon public figures and outside the sort of intimate realm.
Well, it would seem to me that in our politicians that when we sense when a politician convinces us that they are sincere, that connects us to them, that we feel that maybe they're like us, that our values are the same, that that politician actually cares about me and what I think.
That's right. And but the interesting thing is that is entirely true. And that feels really good when you feel like you are listening to a public official or a presidential candidate that you feel really understands you. The problem is we have no way of knowing if that's really true. People are in some senses like a black box. You don't really know what's going on in there. And the more that we demand sincerity, this is something that the sociologist David Riesman wrote about in the 1950s, the more that people demand sincerity from political personalities, the more effort there is on the behalf of political personalities to convince people that they are sincere. And the thing is, everybody knows this. Everyone knows that politicians are often, and I'm not trying to make a cynical argument, but political strategists are very good at coaching political personalities to seem sincere for other reasons. I mean, getting votes is not a bad motivation. That's the point of politics anyway. And there are tricks involved. And I think it's sometimes childish to demand to know the inner lives of political figures when we know what they're really after is winning. And well, that's fine.
I guess I'm trying to understand what sincerity is. If I am trying to be sincere, does that mean I am insincere then?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
It's a difficult place to get to. There's a great quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson who said, "Everyone alone is sincere. At the entrance of a second person, hypocrisy begins," because there's performance involved. And again, that's not necessarily bad, but I think we have to be more aware of that play, that performance, and not think that, you know, because something feels sincere that it necessarily is.
Last September, former Alaska governor and 2008 Republican vice presidential candidate explained to Fox News' Greta Van Susteren why she is a unique type of politician.
Someone like me who's maverick, you know, I do go rogue and I call it like I see it and I don't mind stirring it up in order to get people to think and debate aggressively and to find solutions to the problems that our country's facing.
Sarah Palin's appeal to many Americans was that they found her to be sincere. They're not a regular politician, more like them.
Entirely true. There's part of the book that discusses that in the beginning, not only on Greta Van Susteren, but she was also on the Glenn Beck program early when she was nominated as VP. And she basically reflected upon her time in 2008 as a vice presidential candidate and said there were those who were sincere and awesome that she was hanging around with in her campaign. But then there were also these political strategists, which she defined as sharks, because they were cunning and tactful, or used sort of strategy to get what they wanted. And she made a very clear distinction. And as you mentioned, one of the biggest traits that people responded to in Sarah Palin was that she was sincere. She was an authentic person. She wasn't involved in the whole political game, which, of course, is entirely untrue, because she was a nominee for the vice president of the United States. You can pitch yourself as sincere and feel yourself to be sincere, and it may not be connected to reality. That's the other that's the distinction, I think, that is important.
Is there a class element to this? I mean, do working class and poor people, middle class people, look for sincerity and view intellectuals perhaps as people who are less sincere than they are? Is there anything to this?
I don't know. That's a box of dynamite, that question. I'm not sure. I do know that throughout modern art and literature, I think this gets to the point, modern art and literature, there's been a romanticization of the working class and of people of lesser means to pitch them as somehow more sincere than the wealthy, for example. They're closer to real work, they're closer to the real sort of hardships of life, etc. But often these things are, when they're purely romanticized, they have little to do with actually talking to people that are working class. I'm not sure. There probably is a class element to it, but oftentimes these are also fictions.
You talk about hipster chic, and I guess if I wear a beard and certain types of clothes and Birkenstocks and my hair a certain way, then I have books in my house and no TV, then I'm communicating a certain sincerity about who I am. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that part of the end of the book discusses hipster chic. It's an amazingly interesting cultural phenomena that's popped up in the last, say, 15 years. And exactly those trends are loaded with meaning. So beards and trucker hats, sort of large nerdy glasses, etc. All attempt in some way or another using the tropes of modern art and literature, or the caricatures, attempt to say, I am an authentic person. But they also perform authenticity. And again, as you mentioned before, as soon as you're conscious of trying to project an image of authenticity or project an image of sincerity, that you somehow stand against the crassness of modern culture and kitsch, etc., you the actual authenticity steps back a moment. And often the people that are where these trends come from are often working class sort of trends originally, beards and mustaches and trucker hats. They originate somewhere, and they've been reprocessed and put back into the culture as symbols. And I think that hipster chic definitely relies on these symbols to convey something about each authentic person.
Are you sincere when you say you miss me? Are you sincere every time you kiss me?
You kiss me.
And are you really mine every day, all the time? I'd like to know which way to go. Will our love grow? Are you sincere?
This is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with R.J. McGill, author of the new book, Sincerity, How a Moral Ideal, Born 500 Years Ago, Inspired Religious Wars, Modern Art, Hipster Chic, and the Curious Notion That We All Have Something to Say No Matter How Dull. In January of 1998, Bill Clinton spoke at a White House press conference and denied reports that he'd had an affair with an intern named Monica Lewinsky.
I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false, and I need to go back to work for the American people.
RJ, I was covering that night as a reporter for NPR, and I remember Republicans jeering and giving raspberries and Democrats nodding their head thinking that wasn't so bad. He certainly seemed very sincere when I just listened to him right there, almost like he was pounding the table with his hand to convince us.
Yeah, I love that you can hear the pounding still in the recording. That's great.
We know, don't we? Now we know.
Now we know. And that's just just a little piece of evidence of just saying, hey, you could be really convinced that someone means exactly what they're saying and they could be lying. It's an easy, it's definitely an easy thing to fake. I think there was a comedian whose name, unfortunately, I forget right now, who says, sincerity, once you've learned to fake that, you're made, which means you can do about anything.
Mitt Romney's longtime campaign advisor, Eric Fernstrom, was asked on CNN if Romney risked losing moderate voters because in the Republican primaries he was moving too far to the right. And Fernstrom replied, I think you hit a reset button in the fall campaign. Everything changes. It's like an Etch-a-Sketch. You kind of shake it up and restart all over again. And, of course, poor Mitt Romney was just pummeled for being the flip-flopper and no-substance candidate. But you actually think that this idea of it's fine for Republicans to believe in the Mitt Romney that exists now, not the Mitt Romney who was Massachusetts governor. Yes?
Yes.
Tell me why.
Well, I mean, after the Fernstrom debacle, Romney, well, he came out quickly after that and said, whoa, I wasn't talking about the guy, Mitt Romney. I was talking about his platform, meaning you can have a certain strategy for trying to become president to get the nomination, but then you can switch strategies for the actual national election. That's all fine. And what seemed kind of disingenuous and in the book specifically in the book, I tried to remain very non-political about the whole thing because sincerity sweeps across both aisles quite easily as a moral demand. But what was interesting in that case was the Democrats immediately pinned that description to Romney himself, that he's an Etch-a-Sketch, that he's shake-upable. But the quote actually says nothing about Romney the guy. It's talking about the policy. And there's something disingenuous about the criticism, which is everyone knows that, of course, you switch programs depending on what you're trying to win. And again, that's the appeal to sincerity in that case seems like a distraction. It seems kind of childish. You know, there may be some substance to it. But it seems like something insiders hold up as a sort of a little tiny distraction, because strategy and policy and cunning and tactical maneuvers are how you win elections. And the disconcerting thing is that I do believe voters are smart, and being one also, and we all know this stuff, but it continues anyway. And that there's something sort of very self-flagellating about continuing to hold that as the ultimate standard of whether someone's qualified to lead a country.
To insist on sincerity.
Yep.
Let's take some callers. Ray is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Ray, welcome to the program.
Hi, Wade. To comment really quickly on what you just said, I don't think there's anything wrong with expecting or holding up sincerity. I think the issue is more so in what the voters' reaction to the sincerity might be in terms of what they choose to prioritize. But you mentioned real early on in the show that if someone is trying to be sincere, they are, in definition, not being sincere. And I hear what you're saying, but at the same time, I'm married, for example, and something that I've learned about communication and sincerity, genuineness, et cetera, is that in order to get across your point, the core, the essence of what you're trying to say, you often have to focus on what that person needs to hear in order to understand and receive what you're saying. And that goes, you know, not just for a husband and wife, but so many other situations in life, a boss, an employee, et cetera. So it, while you may be sort of taking yourself out of yourself in order to have that person understand the essence of what you're saying, you are not going to get across whatever your sincere point is if you don't do that. So I don't think that you're sort of, I don't know, I guess it depends on what your definition of sincerity and genuineness and authenticity are, but I don't think you're taking anything away from your authenticity by sort of stepping outside yourself to make sure that you're understood.
Mm-hmm. I think she's talking about maybe not being sincere as a means of being sincere.
Yeah, and to the caller, I mean, being fumbled about the issue, don't feel bad. I fumbled through this whole book. It's a really thorny idea that looks like an easy idea on the face of it, because we think that sincerity is also means naturalness. If I'm just myself and sort of speak without any filters, I'm being sincere. And the opposite of that has often been pitched as having sort of your superego come in and determining what should be said at what appropriate time and so forth. But as you just mentioned, to convey sincerity, oftentimes you have to consider someone's point of view, where they're coming from. And in ancient times, that was called rhetoric. And it was definitely something that if you were a politician in ancient Rome, for example, that you should definitely learn to master, because you could convince people that what you were saying was what you really meant. So, again, does it still count as sincerity if you are strategizing how you'll be received? I think not. And the point of this book is not to say this is the absolute definition of sincerity. It's to sort of pitch it throughout history the last 500 years to say at different times it's meant different things, depending sort of what was going on in the culture and what other influences were happening. But I take your point. It's definitely ambiguous.
Donovan is calling from Spartanburg, South Carolina. Donovan, welcome to the show.
Hi, Wade. Thanks for having me.
Yes, go right ahead.
Well, I was listening to the conversation on sincerity, and I'm a school teacher, and I've taught inner-city school kids, and I've taught some remarkably wealthy ones. And one of the things that how sincerity is played in the classroom that I would like to hear your guest comment as to how it would play in politics is that my students have to sincerely trust that I care about them, and my concern for their well-being must be honest and sincere. There can be no fakeness there. However, they don't need to know my entire backstory. There's a lot that I have done that would, you know, just, I don't tell my students everything about me. They don't need to know it. So that balance of sincerity versus full disclosure, trusting that somebody is going to be looking out for you and has your best interest, you know, as their number one concern versus needing to know everything about that person. And I'd like to hear your guest comment on that very precarious balancing scale and how that might play in to politics as well, because I see, you know, hopefully our politicians are taking care of their constituents as the great teachers would take care of their students.
Well, Donovan, let me ask you, before RJ gets to that, let me ask you, how do you communicate to them that you're sincere about them?
I think it's something that's built over time, and it starts with first not condescending to them, actually listening to them, probably more than speaking. And once that relationship is established where they know that there's an environment where they are free to speak and explore and ask questions and not be ridiculed, and that when there is a disciplinary step, whether it's an academic discipline or a behavioral discipline, it's not a step taken out of anger. It is a step taken for their best interest, and it's explained as such, where instead of, you know, yelling or getting mad, this is what happened, this is what we need to do to fix it, and this is the reason why.
RJ, is part of the art of sincerity listening, not emoting?
Yeah, I think the caller just hit the nail on the head, because what we were talking about all previous to this comment was sincerity being conveyed through language. And what your caller just said was that it happens, this crucial phrase, over time, and that it was actions, not necessarily what you say, but actions that conveyed ultimately the teacher's sincerity. And I think that, again, that really splits the issue into two distinct things. When we hear people saying they're sincere and conveying sincerity, there's room for doubt somehow. But if you're convinced of someone's sincerity or authenticity because they repeatedly act in a way in accordance with, say, a set of ethical principles that they adhere to, that they do things that result and are consistent with things they have said they were going to do, you have something called moral character. And that is that's a definite determinant of whether you can trust the sincerity or not. So, and just to I think that's a really key issue. It's actions over time that can convey sincerity, rather far more so than language. So I thank you for the point.
Charles is calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Charles, hello.
Hi, Wade. I have lived in New Orleans for quite some time, and for over the past 10 years, I give ghost tours in New Orleans. And it is incumbent upon me every single night to be sincere in what I'm doing. I have to, in order to entertain the folks and also lend credence to the stories that I'm telling, because no matter what you believe about ghosts or ghost stories, these are legendary parts of our history that I have to convey with an authentic tone. And, you know, I've got to let people think that, you know, I believe in this stuff as much as I'm hoping they will, because they're coming to our city, and I'm hoping they'll love the rich tapestry of our city and blah, blah, blah. And, of course, ghost stories are part of that. And inherent in ghost stories is the fact that perhaps they might not be true. But I tell them with sincerity because I think most of them are. And so it's something, sincerity is something I have to do, you know, and actually I'm kind of trying to, like, what do I want to say? I'm trying to convince.
No, I think we understand, Charles, and RJ. He's trying to convey a atmosphere of sincerity. Is he being insincere in trying to do that?
I think the more sincerity sort of means not so much about telling stories about ghosts, but about yourself. So it's different. But I think what's important in this point is that you've just described exactly what a fiction writer has to do. and what makes for great literature. That has to be believable. Again, I think this is something that's different than sincerity, because sincerity has to do with revealing a subjective state that you have, not necessarily about fictional things like ghost stories. But fiction writers also struggle with this, the issue of sincerity and an authentic voice, because they're telling untrue things and trying to convey some truth in those illusions. So it is a... And that also gets to the point of saying that sincerity, when it's conveyed, doesn't necessarily have to be true. So it's a strange marker. It's a fiction writers struggle with this all the time.
Emma is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Emma, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Welcome to the show.
Great, thanks. I was just calling to contribute. I'm a college student at a small liberal arts college, and I just noticed a trend. I work in the art gallery at school, and I've noticed that a lot of the kids who are sort of appearing kind of hipster and, cool kids will sort of try and put on airs as if they're from kind of lower class backgrounds and are not really concerned with clothes, wealth, appearance, things that, sometimes in Boston I'll notice, I went to a private school and sometimes those things were valued, but on parents' weekends and occasions like that, I'll see them come into the gallery with their parents, and their parents will be very well off, and I'll watch them, kind of make eye contact, and they'll be kind of embarrassed. So it's just kind of interesting to think about how people are trying to seem sincere and then have to come to terms with the fact that their form of sincerity in college might be very different from what they actually come from and who they might actually be after college. So kind of just thinking about different forms of sincerity in different situations and kind of where you draw the line between who you are and where you come from.
RJ, we're talking about the presentation of self here and how I might like to be perceived as opposed to where I came from.
Yeah, great. That's a great observation. Also very funny. As I mentioned before, some hipster trends like beards and mustaches and glasses and trucker hats and flannel, etc., are a performance. They're part of performing the self in public. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. We all do it. We all do it in different ways. We put clothes on because we want people to see us in a certain way. That's all fine. What's odd about the hipster part is that it's a performance of the unperformed self, and therein lies the rub and the strange irony.
Sincere, honestly sincere, man, you gotta be sincere. If you're really sincere, if you're really sincere, if you feel it in here,
this is On Point. I'm Wade Goodwin in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with R.J. McGill, author of a new book on the history and value of sincerity. And from Twitter, Diana has a question, and she says, what is the role of irony in this culture of sincerity that the guest is describing? Is irony an antidote or a cause?
That is an enormous topic that I try to deal with in the book a little bit. Because when we think of sincerity and irony, we think of them as opposites. If you're ironic about something, supposedly you're not sincere because your words don't mean what they purport to mean. The interesting thing is with cultural outlets like the Daily Show and the Colbert Report or The Onion or South Park, where there's a lot of irony involved. In fact, that's the modus operandi of the entire of Comedy Central. Generally, it seems irony has often, throughout its history, had the task of conveying sincerity, and that sounds like a counterintuitive argument. But if you watch The Daily Show and you really get what's going on, and you watch The Colbert Report and you get what's going on, and you feel a certain connection with the hosts and their points, it's because the hosts are conveying through irony very sincere moral concerns and political concerns as well. So all of a sudden, because satire can do that so well and has done it for the last millennia, sincerity and irony aren't opposites. and irony, especially if you live in a culture of spin and jargon and insincerity, where lots of things, you know, you're being sort of manipulated and so forth. Irony becomes a defense of this sincere ideal by pointing to it not directly. I hope that makes sense.
Comedians are sometimes tortured individuals who make their living not being sincere, being the opposite of sincere. And yet I think that many Americans find comedians to be extremely sincere. And I'm kind of thinking of Steve Martin, the author of the book Born Standing Up, and his torturous route to fame. What is the role of comedy in sincerity?
Well, again, as long as it's comedy more generally, I think it's a more difficult topic. Irony specifically, I think there is this push and pull between irony and sincerity. But as you mentioned, a lot of comics, there's a couple studies out there and a few coming up of the real difficult lives and family pain that a lot of comedians have experienced. And the way that they have been able to deal with that is through, to use a fancy word, sublimation, to express pain and difficult situations and difficult emotions through a culturally acceptable form, namely comedy, namely standing up, because you can sort of either make light of the things that have happened to you, or at least, if not make light, at least that you can get them out there. So all comedy has at its core some degree of sincerity, if you dig down far enough.
Can we talk a little bit about the history of sincerity? I mean, it seems like something that's been around forever, but I know from reading your book that that's not true.
That's not true. And that's the main point of the book, is to trace, mostly in the present, but to trace this sort of really fascinating 500-year history. And I'll try to be brief. Just cut me off if I go on too long. But what's interesting is that it's born in the Protestant Reformation as a moral ideal. And that's not to say that sincerity didn't exist prior to that. Of course it did. But as a valued and lionized moral ideal, there are people like Martin Luther, John Calvin, minor figures like a guy named John Frith in the early 16th century who begin to demand from believers that they search their souls to find their relationship with God and with themselves. And the reason they did that was because many people felt that the church at the time in the early 16th century had really gotten out of step with the basic needs of the people. And oftentimes it had become the church itself, which purported to support the Christian message and promote the Christian message of kindness and equality and so forth, had actually become a destitute place filled with hypocrisy and lies. And oftentimes, these people were absolutely right. Just to give a couple examples, and again, this is just factual stuff, this is laying no blame, but Alexander VI used to keep prostitutes in the Vatican. He had 6 children with 2 mistresses and used to host elaborate orgies in the Vatican. Pope Innocent VIII had 16 illegitimate children and leveraged the papal tiara to pay for the wedding of his illegitimate son, who was a gang rapist. So all these awful sort of things come out in the early 16th century, and people like Luther and these other reformers start to say, wait a minute, this has nothing to do with this kind of Christianity that I thought was important.
There's nothing sincere about this.
There's nothing sincere about it, and moreover, it puts all these mediaries between the believer and God. And this is a big issue for believers then. And what the reformers insist is that people consult their consciences instead of the church. And that's a big gamble, because when you start questioning things like the sacrament of baptism and transubstantiation and all these things, you're committing heresy. And in the 16th century, that's usually punishable by death.
So we were burning people for sincerity.
We were definitely we weren't, but someone the church was. Religious authorities were definitely after reformers who insisted that believers search their hearts instead of listening to church dogma, and this had an enormous influence on Western social life.
So sincerity was seen as subversive.
Originally, yes, it was seen as counter
subversive.
Subversive, and. What's interesting is during the 16th century, when the world picture sort of begins to change and the Reformation is able to upset old hierarchies, people also, at the same time this is happening, become more socially mobile. And cities like London and Paris begin to explode in population. But all of a sudden, you have all these people without a very solid social strata. So they're bumping up essentially against strangers. And how do you know a stranger is what he or she says she is? And you start to value this ideal of sincerity that someone actually conveys to you who they really are. The fear of running into villains and dissemblers becomes rather enormous in the late 16th century, and you can see it in sort of Shakespeare's plays where people display themselves other than they are. So people were very afraid of this, and it also had something to do with the decline of sumptuary laws, which I didn't know much about. But for hundreds of years, these laws used to regulate how people were allowed to dress, depending on your social station, what your profession was, what your religion was. Jews, for example, had to wear certain clothing. When these laws decline and fall out of favor for a bunch of economic reasons, actually, again, you're confronted with a society of strangers, and sincerity becomes all the more important because it shows that you're a true Christian if you can convey with sincerity who you are.
Let's take another caller. Kathy is calling from Harvard. Hello, Kathy.
Hi, Wade. Hi, Ms. McGill. Hi. It's interesting that you just mentioned religion because, you know, I'm not sure how important it is to really peg somebody's sincerity, and I want to refer to the argument for altruism. The argument for altruism is that, are people altruistic really, or are they trying to perpetuate the survival of the species? And I wonder if sincerity sort of comes under that realm. So, you know, are people being sincere because they really care, or because they're just trying to survive? And it's like religion. Can we prove that there's life after death? And so what my point is that, how important is it to know if sincerity or altruism, life after death, is in the best interest of people? Or do we just need to distinguish the fact that somebody who is sincere or does something altruistic is really benefiting us, whether they feel it from the depths of their soul or not? And an example would be if a parent tells their child, "I love you," you know, are they telling the child that, or saving the child's life or survival of the species because it's heartfelt? Does it matter?
Does it have to be heartfelt, RJ?
No, definitely not. I think that's a really, really great point. It gets to some of the early political points, but the altruism thing is really spot on, I think, because ultimately what matters in an act of altruism, especially something like in philanthropy or something, it just matters that the stuff gets there to where it's supposed to go. If you're donating food to an earthquake-ravaged Haiti, it doesn't really matter if the person donating the food really, really cares. What matters is the food gets there. And again, the search for sincerity seems like a side road that leads who knows where. But there's the utilitarian argument, I think, is a good one.
Matt is calling from Memphis, Tennessee. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hi, Wade. Hi, Mr. McGill. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, I think just to follow up from that last caller, I think that the point here is that in this conversation, many times the concepts of sincerity and honesty are confused. Someone can be sincere, I think, to an ideal and not necessarily be honest. And the level of their sincerity is often in the matter. It's judged by, engaged by how they're viewed by others and the frame of reference that others put on them. So, for instance, in the examples of your, you know, the hipsters, and I think you can apply that to any fad or trend, people can engage in behaviors, same with the altruism discussion, that they are being sincere in their belief that that is correct behavior, whereas someone on the outside looking in would say that they're being insincere or they're being dishonest. I really like your point earlier about how the judge of sincerity is the consistency. I think for me personally, the best judge of sincerity is the consistency with someone, you know, ascribing or living out a set of ideals in their behaviors over time. Because without a time horizon to judge, it's very difficult to say someone's not being sincere with what they might feel or think at that moment.
All right. Thank you. Julie is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Julie, hello.
Hi, Wade.
Hello.
Hi. I was having a dinner party one night, and we were discussing this sort of thing, and I was explaining to the gentleman and at the table that when you men tell us that you think we're beautiful and that you're in love with us, we believe that. And one of the gentlemen said, well, we believe that when we're saying it. And the men at the table all agreed, and the women were all bewildered.
RJ, is there this sounds like a difference in the sexes?
Also another box of dynamite.
Class and sex.
Yeah, geez, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like a funny joke, but, you know, a lot of times we mean things directly, you know, in the moment we really mean them and sort of forget them a couple weeks later. It's only, you know, sincerity has this ability, because it's so beloved, we love to shower ourselves with compliments and call ourselves sincere, although really hardly anyone is sincere all the time, and if they are, I probably don't want to meet them. But also, we're also not insincere all the time. There is an absolute give and take with this value that at some times makes sense and at other times doesn't make sense. The example you give brings up a larger point, which I wanted to make in the beginning, which is that you know, we talked about this public face and a political face to sincerity. And then when the caller brought up the idea of or his experience in the classroom, this brings up the point of where sincerity should be demanded. Again, in private life, it seems relevant, including at a dinner party. That seems, you know, that's a sort of ribald little example where, you know, guys are having a good time and making fun. But in the public sphere, I think that's where the demand gets skewed, because public stuff is always performed, regardless of how much you want to believe it.
Did you write the book because you want to communicate to Americans that they should be more skeptical?
Yeah, I think so. And thanks for bringing it up about Americans. I mean, I live in Berlin, Germany, and I've lived there for the better part of a decade. And what I've experienced while living there and experiencing political life is that sincerity is not a demand. It's not even a category of concern in politics. Americans are obsessed with it in politics, in music, in the arts, etc. And again, the book tries to explain the trajectory of why we're so obsessed with it. But if you were to ask about in Berlin, if you were to ask about a politician's sincerity, they would sort of look at you skeptically and say, "What? How would that even make sense? They're politicians. They're talking about their programs, their ideas, their policies. It has nothing to do with subjective life, because it's a bit more technocratic. They're there to do a job, just like an electrician or something. We hire them to run the state." This obsession with the American obsession with the sincerity and heartfelt genuineness of what a politician is or is not doing seems, again, like a category mistake. And I don't think that I could have achieved that kind of perspective if I had not lived in another country for a long time, just to see that it's irrelevant to politics there.
R.J. McGill, author of the new book, Sincerity, How a Moral Ideal Born 500 Years Ago Inspired Religious Wars, Modern Art, Hipster Chic, and the Curious Notion That We All Have Something to Say, No Matter How Dull. It has been a real pleasure having you on the show today. And as a munchkin once famously said, I mean that most sincerely.
Thank you, Wade. Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Wade Goodwin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.